Hi, everyone. I'm Frizo Balstoon.
And I'm Kay Jabelli, and this is Monopoly Attack. So, Frizo, have you heard of Taylor Swift, the girl who was interrupted by Kanye at the VMAs recently?
Recently? Kay, that was 2009.
Oh, geez, I'm sorry. I'm showing my age here. But apparently she's been bringing some much-needed public attention to antitrust in the music industry.
Exactly. I saw that. So yeah, what happened? Ticketmaster started selling Taylor Swift tickets only to verified fans on Thursday, but got completely overwhelmed by demand, leading to tons of fans missing out on tickets. And it even had to cancel the public sale of tickets that would have started the next day on Friday. Now, you know, to some extent, this surely has to do with Taylor's popularity. Hater or lover, she's one of the defining artists of her generation. And if you ask me, her last three albums, which the tour would focus on, were especially good. So a lot of people were mad, and public outcry even led to antitrust attention, with a lot of people focusing on Ticketmaster's market power as the underlying problem.
Market power, you say? Well, that sounds like a job for Monopoly Attack.
My thoughts exactly. Let's dig into it.
So yeah, following this ticketing fiasco, there's been numerous calls to investigate Ticketmaster for antitrust. Disgruntled fans have launched a class action in California, but of course, contingency fee lawyers in the US are always going to take a bite of any big consumer controversy. Is there something more here? Well, in fact, there are ongoing complaints and oversight by the US antitrust authorities. For one, there is apparently, as a result of the reporting around this ticketing fiasco, it's been brought to light that there is an ongoing investigation by the DOJ in the last months. So before this happened, the members of the antitrust division at the DOJ have contacted music venues and players in the ticket market asking about Ticketmaster and Live Nation's practices and the wider dynamics of the industry. And though that's not entirely a surprise, because there have been complaints from competitors going back a while, and you'll note I just said Live Nation's practices, because there's actually two companies that merged back in 2010. So as a result of that merger, there was an ongoing consent decree that was renewed in 2019, which meant that there are certain rules that the merged company has to follow in order to avoid the exercise of their dominant power in a way that's going to be harmful, in order to avoid any anti-competitive conduct that they might be incentivized and now have the ability to make as a result of the merger. That was one of the conditions of letting it go through. There's also been calls for congressional hearings. So we've got all of the big antitrust names in Congress. We've got David Cicilline, who said that it's no secret that Live Nation Ticketmaster is an unchecked monopoly and that the merger of the companies should never have been allowed in the first place. We had Amy Klobuchar, who joined two other senators to sign a letter saying that investigations alone do nothing for the stakeholders already harmed by Live Nation's market dominance, and that there should be a hearing in Congress to cover the online ticketing and music distribution market. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has said that we should even break them up. But maybe before we look into whether we should break them up, we need to understand the industry a bit better.
Yeah, right. That's always a good starting point. And this live music industry is a bit specific. It's, of course, an important part of the music industry because it's where artists make most of their money these days. But there's a lot of relevant parties there who all work together to bring live music to the masses. So on one hand, we got concert promoters. They're sort of the driving force. They organize these tours. They contract with venues where the concerts take place. They do the marketing, make sure the seats get filled up. And they're the one who really take on the risk. So if it's a successful tour, they'll make lots of profits. If not, they'll be bearing those losses. Like I said, they contract with concert venues where the shows take place. But then there's these ticket companies that take care of primary ticketing, as it is called. So they add their service fees usually to these tickets. I mean, if you bought any concert tickets lately, you might have been annoyed at, these service fees adding 10, 20, up to, in the worst cases, 50% of the original ticket price. And of course, then there's artist managers who, you know, represent the artists and sort of make sure they're represented versus all these parties and in particular concert promoters. So that's sort of the short overview, different companies working together to bring live music. But by now, a lot of those roles are actually fulfilled by one big company.
Yeah, a lot of those roles have been filled by one big company, this Ticketmaster Live Nation, this hyphen between the names, which is a clue that they weren't always one company, but they did merge back in late 2009, early 2010. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the merger and the market circumstances at the time.
For sure, because, I mean, Ticketmaster, the big culprit here, their market power goes back a long time, but a defining moment was definitely the merger with Live Nation. Now, at the time, Live Nation was the world's biggest concert promoter and Ticketmaster, the biggest ticketing company, but they were sort of in an antagonistic relationship because Live Nation, the concert promoter, wanted low fees because that meant, you know, that was better for their bottom line. Ticketmaster wanted high fees, but their powers sort of balanced each other out, at least, until Live Nation decided one day, well, maybe I should take care of my own ticketing. So it actually started around 2007, 2008 to enter the ticketing market through an agreement with Eventim, a German ticketing provider. Because they thought, you know, obviously Ticketmaster is getting a high margin here. What if we enter this high margin business and perhaps, you know, do away with some of those high fees, leaving us more and leaving the fans more. And that worked for about a year. They were pretty aggressive, taking over venues from Ticketmaster. Of course, they had their own concert promotion business, so that really kickstarted their own ticketing business because they could essentially deal with the ticketing for themselves. And overnight, Ticketmaster's market share went from 80%, which is near monopoly, to 65%. And it seemed bound to get even lower, maybe up to a point where we'd have the balance between these two companies in this ticketing market. But that's not how it went, because both firms agreed that it would have been in their mutual interest, but perhaps not in the consumer's interest, to merge.
I mean, I think it's remarkable that this was something that was allowed to happen at the time. What's even more remarkable was that Ticketmaster boasts about having acquired its major competitor, Ticketron, back in 1991. So it's not the only acquisition that Ticketmaster has done. In this case, okay, so Live Nation wasn't a huge player already, but they were a fast grower. They were then maverick. They had different business model. They had different interests because they were coming in from a different part of the value chain. And they were able to leverage that and their existing relationships to offer good prices and get into the market and grow their customer base very, very quickly. It was a threat to Ticketmaster, and Ticketmaster kind of extinguished that threat by agreeing to enter into this merger with them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, on this show, we talk about the acquisitions of nascent competitors more often, but that is definitely not limited to the digital space. Here we see, you know, a credible threat to the Ticketmaster near monopoly that was just eliminated through the merger. And Live Nation seemed so well positioned to sort of really make a dent in this market. I mean, taking 15% market share overnight and being bound to grow further, making aggressive moves for these venues that Ticketmaster was ticketing for by offering lower fees. But yeah, it wasn't to be. So now we're in the situation of today, and maybe we could look a bit more about the exact market positions of these companies in their respective or now common markets.
Well, why would the antitrust authorities let something like this happen when it's clearly going to have such a possibility of anti-competitive conduct? They're going to have the ability, they're going to have the incentive to do it with all this stuff. So why would were the antitrust authorities just asleep at the wheel, waving it through? Or
yeah, it's a good question. I mean, maybe ideas about nascent competition were a bit more nascent at the time. I think also this was 2009, 2010. I guess the idea of enforcers was probably that behavioral remedies imposed in this consent decrees could do a bit more good, would have been effective, but that hasn't really turned out to be the case. So if we look a bit at this consent decree, the idea was to create another player, or at least grow another player, because the second largest concert promoter, AEG, got a right to license the ticketing software of Ticketmaster for, you know, a long period of time. And they were hoping, I guess, that this role previously paid by Live Nation could maybe be picked up by AEG, but that's not at all what happened. AEG got, you know, stayed stuck very much in second place. Apparently, it didn't even start licensing the software of Ticketmaster because it wasn't especially state of the art, perhaps another result of its monopoly. So that would be my best guess. I don't know if you see any other reasons for them being sort of oblivious to the potential impact here.
No, I agree. I mean, I think at the time, the competition authorities weren't really thinking too much about behavioral remedies, the problems with behavioral remedies. They weren't really considering so much that companies that said they didn't have the ability or incentive to do something and even would be willing to enter into a consent decree, that then that would have to go and be enforced. And I think it's a testament to how difficult it is to enforce truly behavioral remedies. I mean, these aren't situations where the company can kind of design a product in a certain way, and that's kind of like a quasi-structural remedy. You know, you're creating an API, you're implementing an interoperability protocol. Those kind of things are almost structural. But here, when one of the parts of the consent decree is like, okay, well, you're not going to threaten concert promoters or venues to buy your services from, you know, one of your other services, that's where it's a lot harder to track. It's a lot harder to enforce. It requires a lot more oversight, and the authority really needs to stay on top of it. And I think especially in something like the music industry, where, you know, there's a lot of reputation involved, and the first thing that people think isn't, okay, let me go to the court or let me go to the FTC and make a complaint. We know about the media industry, the way a lot of bad conduct kind of gets swept under the rug because relationships are so important for people to be able to make it up. And if you piss off the wrong people, they can extinguish your career. In that kind of environment, I think it becomes even harder to have a system. Where here, I think there was even more recently, they were putting bounties of $1 million for any violation of the consent decree, basically. Even that's not going to be necessarily enough to ensure compliance.
I agree. I mean, it's such a difficult task to constantly monitor these behavioral remedies from the consent decree. I mean, like you said, like the main prohibition there was that this merged entity, Live Nation Ticketmaster, couldn't retaliate against concert venues that didn't want to go with, you know, the ticketing business of Ticketmaster, but did want those concerts promoted by Live Nation. In reality, I mean, article after article has reported on this exactly happening, you know, in sort of eerie ways with emails to document it. And there's this one exchange from a concert venue writing to Live Nation, like, you know, don't abandon us if there's an issue. Let's address it. Have the concert at our venue. And then the Live Nation executive writing back, issue? Well, it's three letters. Can you guess which they are? And it's because this concert venue was going to go with AEG, the three-letter competitor of Ticketmaster. So this retaliation does seem to be happening. But, you know, these consent decrees have language that might be a bit too vague to capture everything. Once you do see, you know, infringements of the consent decree, you have to start basically a new case. So that takes a lot of agency efforts. So yeah, I guess, you know, today it might have happened differently with competition authorities being a bit more conscious of the difficulty of enforcing these behavioral remedies.
You know, it's not the end of the story. So we'll see what happens next. And they are now obviously under a lot of scrutiny. I don't think anyone's super happy with the way the market is structured. And there are so many concerns around whether artists are getting enough of the profits of their output. I know in the UK, there was this recent publishing of the market study into the music streaming platforms. And they found that the streaming platforms aren't the ones that are kind of extracting too much value from the artist. So it might be coming from somewhere else in the ecosystem. It might be coming from these old school gatekeepers, so to say.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, at this point, it's really difficult to change the competitive situation here because the market power just seems so enduring through this vertical integration that we talked about. You know, they're doing concert promotion, they're doing ticketing. Live Nation even has their talent agency, you know, managing artists. So So just at every level, you know, there's a lever that they can pull. And what's more, these industries structure around these long-term exclusive contracts with venues. So for new competitors, it's difficult to get access to venues that are already covered by those contracts. Just is another barrier to entry. And yeah, I mean, so difficult market structure to sort of compete in or to change anything as a competition authority. But at the same time, we're seeing real harms to consumers from the way this industry is structured. So maybe we should go talk about those a bit.
Yeah, certainly. There's this whole issue of consumer protection. When consumers are going to buy a ticket and they see a price that's advertised, you know, this is the price that the artist kind of wants. They want to make it accessible so that their fans can actually attend. And then you go and you go put the ticket in your cart and all of a sudden there's a huge service fee added on top. There might be a service fee for Ticketmaster. There might be an additional service fee for the venue, and you're not getting the actual price that's being first advertised. That's kind of a simple one. This can also lead to exorbitant prices, especially where there are secondhand sellers or resellers, ticket resellers, who are coming in and buying a lot of the tickets, perhaps sometimes through automated systems. And then they're going off and selling them on secondary markets. So Ticketmaster has an interest, actually, in making sure that these secondhand sellers are getting their tickets in the first place from Ticketmaster and that these are going to be resold. One of the things that they can do, and I think they probably have done in some cases, is that they've got these exclusive agreements with the venues and with the promoters so that they are both the primary ticketing seller and the exclusive provider of the secondary ticket. And there might be various indirect ways of making it harder to sell tickets through a secondhand channel, especially these days post-COVID where everything is digital. You no longer necessarily have like a paper stub ticket that you can hand over to someone else. It's all going to have to be verified. Their identity is going to have to be verified. And it's all going to have to be transferred electronically through the platform.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point on the secondary ticketing. Sort of Ticketmaster passing by the bank twice, right? They sell tickets, a lot of them through scalpers, which they say they try to limit. But then, you know, you see some sort of undercover programs going into their relations with these secondary ticketers, or you know, let's call them scalpers. And you can see that they're actually almost promoting, selling bulk tickets to these people, because when they are then resold on their own secondary ticketing platform, they can take a second cut off the fee. And this is a prices that are often ridiculous. Of course, you know, it turns fans off to artists. So the artists aren't happy. The fans, the consumers aren't happy. But yeah, potentially Ticketmaster does benefit.
But what about competition? What about, you know, innovation? What about new business models? What about coming at it from a different angle? How come competition hasn't been able to work, especially now that so much is online and new entrants can enter digitally?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And I think it goes back to what you just mentioned with this bundling of different services, right? So we have seen some entrants doing interesting things. One example of that was Songkick. And what they focused on was artist pre-sale. So artists want a good relationship with their fans. So what they do is before the general ticket goes on sale, they make sure they reserve some tickets for their loyal fans that are, you know, certified in some way. And Songkick was taking care of that, making sure they identify the right fans, making sure these fans get their ticket at actually a lower price because Songkick charged lower service fees than, say, Ticketmaster. And it made a viable business out of that until they started getting pushback from Ticketmaster, especially after its merger with Live Nation. At that point, you know, the merged entity started dissuading and succeeded in blocking artists from exercising this long-held right to do their own pre-sales via services that are not Ticketmaster. So one thing, for example, that they started requiring was that the artist pre-sale service fees would be the same as the Ticketmaster service fees, which is, of course, you know, makes these pre-sales sort of lose their purpose. And they started tying, saying, you know, if you want a concert promotion by Live Nation, then you need to use Ticketmaster's own pre-sale ticketing service. They can also do pre-sales, but again, maybe not at the same advantageous service fees that Songkick was known for. So yeah, I mean, I guess this is sort of the conglomeral theory of tying and bundling these services together to exclude new entrants.
And it's not too surprising, but a lot of this is just classic contractual or even, you know, indirect contractual, you know, threat and conduct. Don't even necessarily need to have to go and rely on a contract that says, okay, you can't go and sell your tickets on Songkick. Just going at them and using that market power to dissuade the artists or others in the value chain from using alternatives. So it seems like it's going to be a big problem, and maybe we do need to break up Ticketmaster.
Well, hell yeah. I mean, calls for breakup are sometimes overblown, but this merger is clearly one that shouldn't have been let true. So maybe there's a case to be made for undoing the merger, which is sort of, you know, a bit less aggressive at actually breaking up a company that grew organically. You know, undoing a merger, I think you can build a stronger case for that. Yeah, it's hard to think of other solutions under antitrust. I don't know. What do you see as the options here?
Well, there's always regulation. But I mean, is that really going to work? Like you can put a cap on the prices and how much they can charge. But at the end of the day, you're still talking about what? Trying to get 1 million people tickets to a venue that only has 60,000 seats?
Yeah. I mean, in some cases, like the amount of demand is definitely part of the problem. I mean, some artists are just too popular to satisfy every fan. So there's always going to be people that aren't happy. But I think there's definitely ways to make them a bit less unhappy as in the current state of affairs.
A lot of this kind of conduct that Ticketmaster has been doing, and even though they've been under scrutiny, they've continued to do it, and the service hasn't really been improving along with the times. If anything, artists are getting more annoyed and more artists want to be able to go direct to customer, and Ticketmaster has just become this powerful middleman through a number of acquisitions and through exclusive contracts and relationships that they leverage. So, I mean, if you're talking about antitrust intervention and concerns about gatekeepers that block the way between suppliers and creators and enterprises and businesses and fans and users and customers and consumers, this looks like a pretty good case for it.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, so interesting to see what comes out of the DOJ investigation that's going on. Interesting to see whether they'll start actually enforcing this consent decree that they just clarified and prolonged for another couple of years. But in the end, it's a thorny kind of market because there's a lot of, you know, also economic forces at play. And of course, like you rightly pointed out, a lot of this is sort of more goes in the direction of consumer protection with drip pricing and all those kinds of little tricks. But I think that the main message for me here is how difficult it is to intervene at a later stage. Once you let a merger true, that then turns out to be, you know, a mistake. I mean, it's difficult, as they say, to unscramble the eggs. Also, from a legal point of view, I mean, it's a tough argument to make for a court, I think, to say that, well, we need to go back on our steps. We made a mistake all these years ago, and now we need to break up this company again. So maybe that's a reason to be a bit more cautious upfront.
Well, that won't necessarily stop the authorities from trying.
Well, I mean, yeah, in this case, I wish them all the best.
We'll keep an eye on it and maybe there'll be a future episode.
All right. Well, it was great talking to you again, Kay.
Yeah, glad to be back. Thanks, Friezo.